In this program, you're going to hear Seth Godin teach you how to create communities. Seth Godin is the author of 10 books that have become bestsellers. He also writes the most popular marketing blog in the world, and he is the founder of Squidoo, a recommendation website. In this conversation, I talk to him about the ideas behind Tribes, his latest book. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, and I do interviews and programs like the one that you're about to listen to because Mixergy is about helping ambitious startups learn from experienced, successful people like Seth Godin. Here's my interview and conversation with Seth. Oh, actually, let me tell you this. This conversation took place over video chat, so some of it might be visual, but I know that you can get all the value that we had in this conversation from this audio program, and it's probably more convenient for you. All right, here's my interview with Seth Godin. What's the point of having a tribe?
Well, what's the point of making a difference? What's the point of getting anything done? What's the point of having something to say and going someplace different than you were yesterday? A tribe is nothing but a tactic, a method, an approach to getting change to occur. And that change could be growing your business or getting elected or making the world a safer place. But all of those things now require a tribe.
So I'm a big follower of business people. I've got books by Ted Turner, you could see here. Sam Walton, I've studied forever. Here's Malcolm Forbes, who I love. And I don't see that these guys created tribes, which isn't to say that they haven't. I just don't see it. Am I missing something?
Well, the world has changed, and the world has changed really fundamentally because a whole bunch of things that used to be critically important aren't anymore. So, you know, Darren Stevens from Bewitched got rich with Larry Tate because he bought enough TV time to interrupt enough people to sell enough stuff. He can make more money to interrupt more people to buy more TV time, and around it goes. Sam Walton was brilliant in that he understood that local rural real estate was cheap compared to what it was worth. And if he bought enough of it and put up enough stores, he'd have enough leverage to charge suppliers less, which meant his prices would be low and no one could compete with him. And that's a way of leveraging power. Ted Turner made money by understanding that when there were only three channels of TV, if you could build the fourth or the fifth or the sixth channel, you could make a fortune. So CNN and other attempts by him to use cable profited mightily. But now in a world with a million or a billion channels via the web, you can't be Ted Turner anymore.
I see. So you said in your book, in Tribes, that in order to create a tribe, what you need is a message and a way to communicate. Did you mean that people need to be able, that your tribe members need to be able to communicate with each other?
Well, I think it's both, Andrew. It's people like talking to each other. We evolved to want to do that. So one of the most easy, highly leveraged, and powerful ways to grow a tribe is to connect people to each other. On top of that, though, if you just do that, you have nothing but a coffee shop. On top of that, there needs to be a message from you, the leader, about where you want to go, about the change that you want to make in your world. So Twitter is an interesting example. Twitter has no forward motion. It is merely a place that connects people to one another. That's good as far as it goes. But to take it to the next level, what you need is a mission, a movement, a place that people want to get to.
So how did you have people communicate with each other? I feel like I was in your tribe for about a decade, but I wasn't able to communicate with you except through email, and I wasn't able to communicate with other tribe members.
Well, first, it's important to note that I am not the poster child for how to do this properly. Mm-hmm. And number two is everyone does it differently. What I offered members in my tribe is a vocabulary, so that if you were in a meeting and you said purple cow, or said Meatball Sunday, other people who got it would immediately understand what you were saying. So what I did was I gave you a way to connect to those people. Sometimes people will buy 10 or 20 or 40 copies of my book and hand them to other people so that they can then become part of the same tribe because they like living in that world. So I viewed long before digital was a reasonable way to do this, I viewed my mission, my goal, as giving people a vocabulary and a common sense of purpose. And it worked. Now, the internet makes it much, much easier and much, much faster to do it without going to the trouble and expense of writing a book. What you have to do, though, is go through the trouble and expense of spending a lot of time refereeing and ringleading and connecting people online. And there are people who do that far better than I ever will be able to.
I see. And what people are asking me, I ask people who follow me on Mixergy to give me some questions for you. And what they kept asking me was for tactics. And I know in your presentation about tribes in New York, you said that you don't do tactics. But I feel that over and over, they want to know what can they do to implement this, to implement your techniques, to build a tribe for themselves. And very often they feel like they're just alone with their business and don't know how to get started.
Here's the thing, Andrew. My job is to get you to decide. Mm-hmm. That once you decide that you want to do it, it'll get done. Once you decide you want lunch, you don't need to know sandwich making tactics. You'll figure it out. The hesitation that people have isn't that they don't know how to lead. I mean, they've been led all their lives by hundreds of leaders. Mm-hmm. It's not they don't know how. It's that they haven't decided it's important enough. Important enough to overcome the momentum, important enough to overcome the fear, important enough to overcome the obstacles that people will throw in your way on your way to leading. So that when you sit down to write a blog post, it's very easy to back off at the last minute to please everyone, whereas someone who's compelled and motivated to lead doesn't hesitate. They say something that they know will offend 20% of the people who read it because they have to in order to lead the other 80% where they want to go. So there's a million tactics. There's my tactics and there's Colin Powell's tactics and everyone else's tactics in between. You can look at people's tactics and steal them. Tactics are free. What is difficult is choosing, is deciding. And, you know, take your example. There's, a million people on the planet who could have built what you've built so far, but you were the one who set out to do it and actually did. Why? Because you knew the tactics? No, because you decided.
I've done interviews with people where I've asked them about message boards online, and they say that creating even a message board, a simple way of organizing a tribe, is effective, but most message boards end up with maybe five people who are talking to each other, and eventually they just go away. It's a lot harder, I think, than it seems to create a tribe. It's harder than just deciding. And speaking of blogs, the reason that we can blog today is because the systems are so easy, because anyone can go into any number of sites and create a blog, everything from MySpace to implementing your own WordPress installation on your site.
Well, you know, setting up a Ning network is a pretty trivial endeavor.
Once you set a Ning, you've got such a passionate community on Ning. In fact, if you open it up to more people would come in, and I know that the community itself said, we don't want any more. That's how passionate they are. I looked around at other Ning networks, and most of them don't have nearly as much activity as yours does. Most of them don't have nearly as many people. What's the difference? How do you get it, and how do the rest of us get that many people into our communities?
Well, you know, there are two things you have to do. The first thing is you have to be doing something that people want to follow, that people want to join. So, you know, if you look at Bill Richardson or Barack Obama, how did Barack Obama end up with millions of people sending him hundreds of millions of dollars and Bill Richardson didn't? It's because Barack Obama lived a life, said a story, acted in a way, communicated in a way that made people want to follow. Whereas Bill Richardson just said, here I am, take it or leave it. And so most people are selfish. Most people say, here's my business, please join me. Well, no, I'm not going to join you. The success of your dry cleaner is irrelevant to me. Whereas, you know, the restaurant right over there down the street, he needed to raise money for the place he's opening across the street, so he started selling gift certificates in advance. And people were buying $5,000 worth of gift certificates to help fund his restaurant so he could open. Why? There are plenty of other places to eat, but not where John is cooking, not because of the personal, that they don't have the personal connection that he has. So the second half of it is you have to be doing something worth supporting, and the second half is you have to ask for it. You have to directly connect with people and say, I need you in my synagogue. I need you in my church. I need you in my political party. I need you at my cocktail party. And it's not that sort of aggressive, over-the-top, offensive networking. It's the positive flattery, the ego gratification of being asked by a leader to join him or her. And most people fall down on both fronts. They're offering something not very useful, offering something selfish, and when people don't show up, they just walk away and say, this is too hard for me to do. And I think the alternative is to find a small piece of change you want to make. We need AstroTurf at the high school. Well, you can find the people who agree with you. And if there aren't enough people who agree with you, you need a new cause. And then you can connect them to one another and the cause. You know, in my town, it's easy to get 300 people to show up at a zoning meeting because you can find the people who care. And if you're not finding the people who care, it could be because you're making the wrong offer.
I see. You know, I did an interview about how politicians are using online online tools to build their message. And one of the examples that kept coming up over and over was MoveOn, that in the early days, MoveOn wasn't as big and didn't cover as many issues as they do today. They covered one issue, let's move on past all the criticism of Bill Clinton. And that's how they drew in a community. So you're saying do the same thing. Find one small change that people can rally around, champion that, and then build from there?
I think that's one of the tactics that works extremely well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The thing to understand here is if it was 1962 and I had written a book about advertising, it wouldn't be useful to say, what's the best kind of ad to run? Or I ran an ad and it didn't work. That the purpose of a book when David Ogilvy was writing a book on advertising was to say, any yutz who sticks with this will make money. And once you got that message, then you could persistently cycle over and over and over again until you figured it out. Well, the same thing's true here. It's not one size fits all. Different approaches will work for different tribe leaders. My only point is, and I gave 400 examples in a 140-page book, it works if you get it right. How you get it right, I don't know. What I know is that people who stick with it, who are passionate and transparent and motivated, they keep succeeding.
And you said earlier, if people don't show up, you have to just keep at it, keep at building your community, keep at the goal of creating a tribe.
Yeah, I mean, I heard someone on the radio yesterday talking. She was a photographer for Time magazine, and she was relating the idea that at the beginning of the campaign, the only people traveling with Barack Obama were a driver and her, right? Impossible to imagine today. So every movement starts with nobody but the leader. And when I started my blog, it had 3 readers a day. It didn't have a lot of readers at the beginning. 3 readers and 4 readers and 6 readers and 9 readers. The same opportunity is there for everybody. It's easy to start now. You used to need $1 million to go on television. Now you need $12 to go online. But just because it's easy to start doesn't mean it always works, because lots of other people are starting. What it means is the people who push through the dip and get over it and make it to the end thrive, even though they only put in $12.
I see. All right. The heretical message seems to be at the core of this, that if you have a message that people will criticize, if people will fight, you also have a message that an audience can gravitate towards. How are heretical messages created? Most of us don't sit around and think, I want to be a heretic. We sit around and say, I want to build a big business so that I could be profitable, so that I could get money. How do we even start to think of creating that message?
Well, you're traveling in different circles than me. I don't know anybody who says, I want to make a big business so I can make money.
Really?
I'm pretty sure there are people like that. But in my experience, the people who make big businesses and make money are passionate about something. They are trying to change something for the better. Mm-hmm. They are trying to make an impact on a marketplace or on individuals or on users or on a community. And that is where business success comes from. So that, the guys who started 1-800-GOT-JUNK didn't say, well, we could start anything we want. What should we start? what they saw was an opportunity in the marketplace, and they became evangelical about it. They became passionate about it. They understood that they could empower people to start local businesses and make money from it, that they could make people's lives more efficient. And by becoming passionate about their cause, then they could find people who were willing to talk about it. They could create a message that spread. And so if you say, there's a marketplace out there, how do I make money from it? Well, I'm not surprised at all you can't find people to follow you. But if, on the other hand, your goal is to help people, even if it's to help them make money, there's a message there to spread. And it is heretical, because the status quo message is, go to work, do your job, go home, die.
I see. Okay, what about bribes then? In several of my interviews, I've been hearing about bribes, seeing them pop up over and over. A.J. Vaynerchuk, who you wrote about his brother in your book, A.J. Vaynerchuk and his brother and a partner got together and they created a t-shirt website. And in order to get people in their community, which is now active and thriving, they gave away random t-shirts to people who joined the community. Hacker News, which I did an interview with some of their members, in order to get people to start participating in that online community, they said, we'll pick the top users and we'll give them access to a special event that other people can't come to. Do tribe leaders take away from their message by giving out bribes? Is that an important part of it? What do you think of this issue of bribes?
Well, let's be really clear on the semantics. A bribe is when you give somebody money to do something that is against their nature or against their fiduciary duty. When you give a congressperson money to vote against her constituents. I don't think bribes are a good idea. I think that recognition, I think that rewards are a great idea. I think that if you go to any spiritual institution, there's always some layman up on the podium who's being recognized for doing something. A friend of mine did some work for the Pope of the Eastern Orthodox Church, and they had a brand new building in Istanbul. And he walked in, and there's pictures of all the popes that have been there before, lining the walls for the last 1,500 years. And right behind, over the guy's shoulder, was a more modern one. And he said, "Who's that?" And the Pope said, "Oh, that's Dr. So-and-so from New Jersey. He gave us the money to build the building." You know, well, I'm not sure he did it so he could get his oil painting in there. I don't think it's a bribe, but I think it's recognition. And what tribe leaders understand is that you need to treat different people differently, and that different people are going to contribute differently, and that recognizing them makes perfect sense. The other thing that you notice is that tokens and prizes and rewards are valued far out of proportion to their cost, because people don't do it for the ball of cotton from China. They do it because being recognized is one of the things humans want more than almost anything else.
I see. So you're saying that if somebody gets a t-shirt from AJ, it's not so much about the t-shirt, but about being picked by AJ, being singled out and thanked by him personally. That's probably more powerful than getting that tchotchke.
Totally, unless they think he's manipulating them. You know, if he says, I can do this for $12 and get people to do a lot of work that I would never be able to pay for, here's your $12 t-shirt, that feels cheap. That's really off-putting. Mm-hmm. That what works is when, in a genuine, authentic way, the tribe leader, for a really good reason, recognizes someone. And you may think it's easy to fake this, but it's not, because you have to do it for too long in front of too many people to get away with it.
I see. All right, you said that recognition is important, and I did an interview with Mateo Gutierrez, who for the last 10 years have been creating tribes largely for game sites. So he found that if he just gave people outfits for their online avatars and gave them recognition with a special outfit, they would feel proud, they would do more work for the community, and they would be a bigger part of it. But he also found that by building a community that was that big, he set himself up for potential enemies. So if the company that he worked for ever did anything wrong to their tribe, the tribe would start attacking it. They would hit them with so many server requests that they bring down the whole online community and so on. How do you keep from creating a tribe that's more powerful than you and can take you down?
Well, all tribes are more powerful than the leader. The question is not how do you keep them from being powerful. They already are. The question is how do you so closely associate the success of the tribe with the success of the individual that the typical individual would have no incentive to want to take down the tribe. The asymmetrical nature of the internet is fascinating. You know, if we look at almost any religious institution, 1% of the people at any given time want to tear down that institution because they've been brokenhearted or double-crossed. Mm-hmm. But they don't have any leverage, so they can't. They just end up leaving. If you give them leverage the way they can online, what can happen is that angry 1% can bring the whole thing down. That the angry 1% can hack or vandalize or whatever in a way that really hurts you. I think that there are two answers to that. The first one is you need to embrace the 99%, the 99% that identify your success with their success, the ones who rally when your website's going to go out of business and send you money for no good reason, the ones who put in the extra hours to keep it going. Why are they doing that? They don't know you. They don't care about you. They care about themselves and their friends. And then the second thing to do is to really pay attention to the asymmetrical nature of the internet. And one of the things I've been very outspoken about is I think anonymity online is a bane. It's a curse. It doesn't work. And one of the things that anonymity online does is it creates asymmetrical events. One person with a macro can fill a blog with thousands and thousands of comments that you have to then painstakingly delete by hand. But when you eliminate anonymity, when you know who people are, as you do in the real world, the asymmetry tends to go away because people are going to act in a way that they're proud of because you know who they are.
Speaking of, is that why you don't have comments on your blog? Because comments allow for anonymity, but pingbacks, which you do have, don't allow for anonymity?
Well, I don't allow for comments because I'm clinically neurotic.
I see.
And what happened was I started writing anticipating the 1% of the readers who would angrily respond to what I wrote, who wouldn't understand it, who didn't get a piece of shorthand. And if I wrote one more paragraph, then they'd understand it and they'd like it. And within 3 days, the posts I was writing were either boring, banal, or indecipherable. And I realized I had a choice. Choice number one is I could fix my problem. I don't know how. Choice number two is I could stop blogging. Or choice number three is I could say I don't have room for anonymous comments. And if you want to make a non-anonymous comment on your blog, terrific. I'll point right back to you. And I know it's controversial to take this point of view, but the only other choice I can think of is to stop. And my readers have asked me not to do that.
I notice when you write a book, you use the ideas in the book to promote it. You did Purple Cow, and you gave away a carton of milk that was all purple.
I'll go get it. Here it is.
You're one of the few people who have that. You can no longer anywhere, right?
No, it's a collector's item.
So you did that for Purple Cow, and I wish I bought it. I don't know how I missed out. For tribes, you created a tribe for yourself. This is intentional, right?
Yeah, you know, if you're not willing to eat your own dog food, you shouldn't make it. Mm-hmm. And if I was a surgeon, I'm not sure I'd do kidney surgery on myself. But if you're talking about marketing, you really sort of have an obligation to market in the way that you say works.
Have you tried it once for one of your books and found that it didn't work, that it failed, that you needed to tweak the idea a little bit?
Oh, it fails all the time. You know,
can you give me an example?
The book Free Prize Inside came in a cereal box.
I remember that.
To go with the milk, right? And it failed. The reason it failed is because you need to tell a story, and this is from All Marketers Are Liars, you need to tell a story that resonates with the people you're telling it to. Well, the story I was telling to bookstore owners is it's okay to have a book that doesn't look like a book and that you can't browse. And bookstore owners hated it. So a third of the bookstores shrink-wrapped it for some unknown reason, and a third of the book owners opened the cereal box and threw it out for some unknown reason. So that's a failure. It turns out there was a free prize inside the book. And I should have been a little less literal there and used the concept more than the actual idea. And in All Marketers Are Liars, the point of the title was that you tell a story to people whenever you do any marketing. And the mistake I made was telling a story that didn't resonate with the very people I needed to read my book, marketers. That if they didn't understand what I was trying to say, when you hear the words "all marketers are liars," four words, you think I'm insulting you. You think I'm Naomi Klein or something. And in fact, that's not what the book's about at all. But it probably cost me 50,000 copies to have a title that was very self-referential as opposed to one that was just clear.
What would you have done instead for All Marketers Are Liars? All Marketers Are Storytellers would have been too literal for you.
Yeah. I mean, it's too late to come up with a new title, so I haven't wasted any cycles on it. But I think that something way less linear than that would have probably pushed it over the top in a way. You know, it's a book I'm very fond of, and I wish more people would read it, but you only get one shot.
And you've said that if instead of writing about the internet, you created a search engine back in the early days, that you would have been richer. You might have been Sergey Brin today. Do you ever regret going down the path of being a teacher instead of creating more websites, more sites like Squidoo?
No, because if I did, I would, right? I mean, I don't have to go back 20 years. There's so many opportunities today that we're going to, 10 years from now, say, wow, 2009 was an unbelievable time to start a website. I can't believe I didn't start X. I find that I don't have the fortitude to build a 90-hour-a-week company for 5 years, and I don't think I ever did. I really enjoy the idea of pushing other people, helping them, shining some light, and then jumping on to the next thing, coming back to that one. I can stick with things for a long time. I just can't do it for 14 hours in a row.
I see. And so Squidoo isn't a 14-hour day job for you. You've got people who are running it then.
Yeah, the idea with Squidoo was find people where every single person who works on the company is better at their job than I am. Whereas it's very tempting for an entrepreneur to hire people who they can then swoop in and do a better job at their particular task. And it took a lot of discipline on my part to devise a company where there was no job where I would be the best at it. And so I disrupt the organization. I cause a ruckus on a regular basis. But every single person who works with me is better at what they do than I am.
And speaking of people who work with you, you created a unique MBA program. Can you talk about that? Just give a quick description for people who don't know it and tell us where you are with it.
Sure. We start in 12 days. I'm very, very excited. I'm calling it the Alt MBA. It's 6 months. It's free. You get a certificate suitable for framing at the end. We have 10 unbelievable people, and it's not going to be very public. The goal is not for me to put on a show, a reality show and let everyone watch. The goal is for me to sit around this table right here with 10 really cool people, pushing each other, them pushing me pushing them, to learn what does it take to be a successful entrepreneur, tribe leader, impact maker today that's so different than the stuff I needed to learn when I went to Stanford Business School. And my hope is that you will hear a lot about these people and from these people in the years to come.
What's next? What's the next book that you're working on?
I can't tell you.
Really?
Yeah, sorry.
What areas are interesting to you? I never would have predicted that you'd come up with a book on tribes. I never thought of tribes as a way of spreading a message, but obviously it is. What other ideas are there? Maybe ones that you've considered writing a book about but didn't think there was enough
material. It's been a long time since Bennett Cerf wrote his big book of jokes and riddles, and I think we need a new one. I think that what the internet has changed is this. We no longer need books to figure out how to do stuff. Anything you want to know how to do, you can learn online for free right now. What we need books to do is persuade us to do stuff. And lucky for me, because that's what I'm pretty good at. So the books I'm interested in writing and reading are books to persuade one to do something, persuade you to try cooking Mongolian food, persuade you to see what happens if you, you know, do deeds a different way for different people. And so that's what I'm working on. And it's going to be a long time before my next book comes out, because I've decided to spend a lot of time on this Alt-MBA thing, spend a lot of time sort of really digesting the impact of my last couple books. So don't hold your breath.
Can you tell us more about what the Alt-MBA is going to be? Will we be able to follow along from a distance? Will people who didn't get accepted, and I know that you must have gotten tons of applications, will they be able to follow along with what you're doing on the blog? Will they be able to do it themselves with organizations around the country? I'd love that.
Well, there are some people who are sending up Alt-MBA stuff online with without me, which is great. We are not going to do this thing in public. We are not going to be publishing our results on an ongoing basis. We may end up having artifacts that we create as we go. Mm-hmm. But I know it's not the way of the web to not leverage this thing, but we're not leveraging it. We're just doing it.
All right. Have you heard? Can you tell us some of the stories of people who've used your ideas and have seen dramatic differences? You're a great storyteller. I know that every time you write a book, you must get flooded with emails. I know I got flooded with emails from people who told me about some of the successes they've seen from your book, and they told me they emailed you. Can you tell us some of the more exciting ones?
Well, I'll tell you three. Mm-hmm. And I hesitate to do this because it certainly doesn't sound like I'm being humble. But
good.
You asked,
good.
And I feel like I should share these. I got one from a guy who started a church with 18 people in it, and now it has 3,000 people who come every week. Mm-hmm. I got a note from someone who worked.
How did he tell you what he did to get there?
It started with Purple Cow Thinking, mm-hmm. and then really embraced a lot of the stuff that was in Free Prize Inside and All Marketers Are Liars. It was about connecting people, about being remarkable, about telling stories, about reinventing the status quo of what it meant to run a spiritual institution, looking at the rules and saying, why do we have that rule, and replacing it with one that made more sense. Mm-hmm. I got another note a couple weeks ago from a guy who made $19 million last year. His words, not mine. He did it completely following my books. He used some of the ideas in Meatball Sunday, a lot of the ideas in The Purple Cow, to go into an industry that was totally broken and stuck and old and boring, and shake it up and realize that there is an enormous amount of value there if you have the guts to unveil it, if you have the ability to say, this is something people have wanted for a really long time, but let me put it to them in a different way. So that was one. Another one is one of the people who worked on a presidential campaign came to me and explained that the very senior people in the campaign had three of my books on their desks all the time, which I thought was pretty cool, because sometimes I write for people like that. Mm-hmm. You know, I often write for people in small organizations because there's a lot more of them and I understand them better. But particularly in All Marketers Are Liars, I was very motivated by the election before this one to talk about the huge mistakes that the candidates made in the way they told stories, in what they stood for, and how they demonstrated their thinking. Because in some cases, the thinking is wrong, but often it's the storytelling that doesn't match. It's the mismatch between the two. And the last example I'll give you is a note I got from a 13-year-old girl 3 days ago. She's been reading my stuff for a couple years. Last year, she raised hundreds of thousands of dollars for charity. She's gives speeches in middle schools and high schools around the country, and she gets it, and she's 13. She has no money to spend. She has no college degree. She has no high school degree, but she's seeing in people what makes them tick, And it's not TV ads and it's not factories. It's something much more true to our nature than that.
And that, again, it's in all those examples, it's the books that cause the results. You blog all the time. You give away your ideas for free all the time. You can get everything that Seth Godin's ever said for free online in one way or the other. But you're saying that the books themselves are what make the impact.
No, I don't think that's true. I just happen to pick examples like that. I get at least as much mail about the blog as I get about the books. Mm-hmm. You know, back to something you said earlier. I don't do any of this to make money, Andrew. And that's why it works. That's why it makes me money, is because I don't do it to make money. There's zero revenue from the blog. That's the point. The point is I can't possibly try to make money from a blog that has zero revenue. That's why the effort that I put into it is true. It's there because I have no other motive. There's no ulterior motive. It's there to spread an idea that I believe in. And no one can pay me enough to put an idea in that I don't believe in. And so people are more likely to read it and think about it and take action on it because they know why I'm doing it. And I think that even if you work in a business that makes a profit, you can act that way.
So find the passion, find what you want to do, what you have to get out there in the world. Do that, and then you're saying the money will follow and the business and everything else?
I'm saying even if no one read my blog, I would still write it.
Did you before you wrote a blog, did you have a journal that basically had the same ideas that now you're releasing on your blog? Or is it...
I don't really have the patience for a journal because I can't write with my hands. It doesn't go fast enough. But, I've been riffing like this for a really long time. And so it's great. The people I used to riff to are delighted because now I can leave them alone and just type it up.
And I know we're delighted too because now we get to actually have contact with you. We get to learn from you every day. I love your blog. And I love, you know what else I love? I love when I go around the internet and I see ideas that were inspired by you. Mark Hirsch has a site called GooToDo. I signed up for it and I noticed that you were the inspiration for it. Some blog post that you wrote gave him an idea and now the rest of us are using GooToDo.
Yeah, Mark's a very smart guy. I found him with an ad I ran in Wired magazine with my baby picture in it. And we worked together for a little while. This is Broken is a project that he worked on for a really long time that was based on a lunch we had because I was so frustrated at all the things in our lives that are broken and shouldn't be. There's a book someone should write. This is a Broken book.
This is Broken.
So, it gives me a great deal of pleasure when I see an idea and if I don't get credit for it, it makes me even happier because it means it's really in the ether. It's not just straight from me to somebody else. Mm.
Yeah, I did an interview with the guys who created Talk Like a Pirate Day, and I asked them if they care that people didn't know that they were the ones who created it. They said the people who need to know, and the people who don't, it just means it's spreading faster.
They probably said, "Oh, the people who need to know."
A couple of other questions. So this interview is going to be summarized and put up on Mashable.com, a website for people who are creating internet companies. What should they know now going forward into a tough economy to help them build up their companies, to help them survive this time?
Well, I love Mashable. I didn't know we were going to be on Mashable. I'm thrilled we're going to be on Mashable. Hi, Mashable. Hi, Pete. You should know this is the best thing that could ever happen to you because it makes it easier to be the winner when so many other people are dropping out. The dip is closer and shallower than it would be if these were the boom times. The emphasis should not be on how do I raise money and hire people. The emphasis should be on how do I build value today? Because if every day you're doing this, you're building value, connecting with people who find you irreplaceable, then you will become irreplaceable. If you understand that in a down economy, not only is there less money for people to spend on you, but you have to spend less money to make stuff that's worthwhile, you can balance those two against each other. You know, it makes me sick to see – oops, did I do that?
No, it's good.
It makes me sick to see organizations that race out to hire 50 people because they think that get big fast matters, and then it's not their fault when they lay off 20. Well, sure it is. It's totally your fault, Mr. Entrepreneur. You shouldn't have hired 50 people to start with. And that the goal is – not how fast can you hire as many people as you can. The goal is how irreplaceable are your people? How much can you boil down the essence of what you're building? So that when we look at the big home runs online, they're not the Daily Beast with $18 million spent and hundreds of people. They're Twitter with a tiny team of people who have a very fine, focused vision. Now, one of the things the guys at 37 Signal say is if you want to be on budget and on time, what you're going to have to do is the day you hit the budget or the day you hit the deadline, you got to ship. And it's a race. So that's how you do it. You don't say, how do I get more money to match the spec? You say, how can I get the spec out there for the money I have?
What about what I'm doing here at Mixergy, where I'm interviewing people to teach internet companies how they can, to teach internet companies how to build themselves up? Have you been seeing what I've been doing here?
You're famous.
I've been pounding you with emails for 5 years, I think. Trying to thank you for everything that you've done by writing these books, and then eventually to try to get you to do an interview. I'm grateful that you're doing this. What convinced you to do this interview?
Well, it might be your natural good looks. It might be the fact that you're famous. I don't think you've ever asked me before. I think the reason I said yes is because you asked me.
So just ask. That's what I have written down here. I think 3 or 4 times. Ask people to join your tribe. Ask people to be a part. Ask for interviews. That's what it all comes down to.
No, it doesn't all come down to that, because at least once a day I get a email asking me for some ridiculous, selfish thing someone wants, and then they write under it as if it excuses them, you can't blame a girl for asking. Mm. Well, actually, I can, and I will. If you ask someone to do something that's selfish for you, they won't. And not only won't they, they'll never forgive you for asking because you made them really uncomfortable. That the asking I'm talking about is equivalent to asking someone over for a cocktail party, asking someone to go out to dinner with you. Those are things that help both of you, not just help you. And so there are lots of times someone will send me a note saying, you know, I'm going to be in town. Can I take you out for a sandwich? I'd love to pick your brain for an hour. No, you can't. I'm sorry. I don't know you. I'm really busy. I'm not good at meetings. I hate meetings. I don't even like sandwiches. No. Because it's not about me at that point. It's about you. And I'd like to be generous, but there are too many people for everyone to be generous to. So when you're asking for money for your charity, when you're asking for a vote for your political candidate, when you're asking for someone to spend time with you, you got to think really hard about why they ought to do it that has nothing to do with you. So I'm doing it partly because I like organizing my thoughts like this, and partly because I want people like you to succeed. Because if people like you just don't succeed, then it's really hard for people like me to spread the word. And so if I can help you by doing this, I'm going to benefit, and I'm glad to do it.
Well, you have. I really appreciate this interview. Thank you, Seth. Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Have fun.
Bye.
All right, and there's the interview. Now that it's over, here are a couple of suggestions. Number one, go to sethgodin.com. That's where you can read Seth's blog, find out about his latest books, and find other ways to connect with him. Number two, go to mixergy.com, where you can find other programs just like this with people like Seth Godin who are going out of their way to help you learn and give you the support you need to build your startup. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you on mixergy.com.